Good morning. Welcome back to hour number two of Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad that you could join us for the second part of the program. The third round of Middle East peace talks ended on Wednesday in Washington, D.C. The parties to the talks seem as far apart today as when they began last fall. There has been no agreement on when talks will resume or where they will be held, although it's possible that there may be another session coming up in April before Israeli elections in June. We're very honored indeed this morning to have with us the head of the Jordanian delegation to the Middle East peace talks, Dr. Abdel Salam Majali. He is visiting here in Champaign-Urbana and was good enough to come in and share some of his thoughts with us on how the peace talks look from the Jordanian point of view. You will also have the opportunity, as with all of our guests, to call in and talk with him if you have questions or comments. Our telephone number here is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, which is good anywhere you can hear us around Illinois or Indiana. Those are the little bits of states where the signal travels. Please feel free to use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Our guest has been, for a long time, a leader in Jordanian education. He has served as the head of or president of the University of Jordan, and also has served in government in a number of capacities, including as Minister of Education and of Health. We're very pleased to have you with us here this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Inge.
At this point, it seems, at least from what one reads, as I said in the couple of brief comments I made to introduce things, that it seems that we, at least on the issue of the resolution of the status of the Palestinians in the occupied territories, that there is a rather wide gulf between the Arab side and the Israeli side, as at least the Israelis and the Palestinians have presented one another with their visions of the occupied territories. And they seem to be quite far apart. And the major sticking point seems to be the interest on the Palestinian side of moving towards a Palestinian state, and the continued reluctance on the Israeli side to even begin that process. And that seems to be the major point where things are stuck. How do things look to you, and do you see some possibility of working that out?
Well, let me start by saying that we are not too far apart, because this is generalization, which is not very accurate. In the last 3 months, lots of things have changed and lots of things have been bridged. And on the top of the list, that there is a Palestinian entity in the negotiation. And it's been recognized, and there is a track which called Palestinian-Israeli tract, where the Palestinians themselves negotiate directly with the Israeli. In the same time, there is a Jordanian-Israeli tract where Jordanians negotiate with Israel on Jordan-Israeli problems. So these things are definite. They were not in existence in this sort of a sense before the whole process has started in Madrid just about 3 months ago. And again, there is a lot of things which has taken place, that people talk with each other, no more hostile in their language. They are trying to understand. But as you know, in negotiations, always people will start with their maximums, and gradually they will bring themselves to better understanding and better trust and better this. So the gaps go on closing. So what has happened after we finished with the problem of tracks? The Palestinians produced a document to the Israeli of what they think of this interim self-government arrangement, which they're going to negotiate from now till the end of this year, which, again, it is being planned that this go on for 5 years. On the third years of the 5 years, there will be negotiation about the final status of the Palestinians. So they ask that this should be a real good interim where opportunities on building confidence building between the two and trying to live in a better peaceful way rather than confrontation way, they should have enough democratic procedures for them as a government. So they are asking that they should have free elections to elect a council, where this council from this council to have their government be appointed, and then to run their show. They have not said that the Israelis should withdraw now, and this might be in the second phase for the negotiation. While the Israeli side still believe that these people only will give them almost the... they are aliens on other people's land, so to speak. They still claim that this land is Israeli land and these people are alien, but they are living here. So they want to give them some sort of autonomy. One can see the vast difference between the two, but as far as the two are sitting to negotiate, so the hope is there that they will become more and more gradually to understanding and trying to bridge the gap and come to a proper formula where both sides can accept it. One must remember, in negotiation for peace, there is no winner and a loser. There is no winner and a loser. All parties have to be winners. But the difference, some people may win today, some people may their arrangement that they will win tomorrow or after a month or a year. So they have to be assured, both sides, won the term of this this benefit to them, or this winning to them comes, and it should be always with a good balance on both sides, using common sense, using understanding, using all the necessities for this. The second point is, when you negotiate for peace, you have to completely divorce from the ideas of war. But if you have the ideas of war at the back of your mind and you are talking peace, you talk and you are afraid, you are very worried and so on. So you may not come. So this has to be changed. No more wars. No more wars. Now peace, so it is, should be this, the state of mind of peace. Unfortunately, we find so far that the Israeli have not put a strategy for peace. Still, they are with the strategy of war, which is built on Arab rejection all the way through in the last 3-4 decades. So they're still going on. In fact, if we notice and if one follows what's going on, every time we have a meeting, just prior to the meeting, maybe a day or two, there is a provocation to provoke the Arabs to walk out, for instance, announcing building settlements or putting people in jail or bombardment of a certain villages and cities, whether in Lebanon or otherwise. So these incidents are planned in such a way that one feels that they are meant to provoke, they meant that to stir the Arabs so they will walk out of the peace conference. And it could be just a test. It could be just that the Israelis are trying to test the other side, whether they mean business or not. If they walk out, which means that they are not going anymore for peace. And if they stick to it, which means that it's peace. And I hope this is the test, so it would be culminated that now with the Israeli election coming, that the Israeli people themselves will give a mandate of strategy of peace to the, whoever they will elect. Mm-hmm. As leaders for the coming phase, because the present leaders, they were elected in the time when the idea of rejection and war was in the heads of people. So they had a certain strategy. But now, with what's going on in the last 3-4 months, with the change in the world, with the fall of the Soviet Union, with the Gulf War and the new world order, things have changed, and one has to be to change with them. Otherwise, the force itself will change you.
Apparently, the Bush administration yesterday had some rather critical things to say about the Palestinian delegation, and their and essentially blamed the Palestinians for the lack of progress. And I'm not sure if you had the opportunity to read some of these stories. Certainly, the Bush administration has been quite critical of Israel and its settlement policy. But in this case, they seem to want to be blaming the Palestinians for lack of progress, saying that what they have asked for has been unrealistic. I wonder what your reaction to that criticism would be.
I don't want to put myself as if I am, you know, defending this or the other, but even as an observer, one must remember the composition of the Palestinian delegation. Israel refused to sit with a delegation which has been appointed freely by the Palestinian people. So she put a lot of conditions on who to sit with. One is not PLO, second not from the diaspora, third not from Jerusalem. Fourth, they have to swear that they accept the Israeli, they recognize them, and they accept these two tracks. Too many conditions. So the delegation, the Palestinian delegation, is not a delegation of a state which is a coherent, which has a certain definite mandate and sit and talk, while the Israeli delegation is a delegation of a government like us. We are a delegation of a government. We are a state. So these people are afraid, and every day they feel with their people. Every day there is a killing, there is eviction, there is people put in jail. In fact, four of them, they were put in jail, four of the delegates. So you must imagine the psychology and the state which the Palestinians have. So they are sticking to the maximum. At least they want some sign from the other side that they are willing. So far, they do not have it. And the Palestinians do not have the chips. The chips are in the hands of the Israelis. So the Israeli can give the Palestinians, what can they give? So this is, I think, the situation which has taken place in the negotiation. I would not deny that they have put the maximum, but when daily, the incident take place. These people have to go back. They are not protected. They are vulnerable to the constituency, and they're going to be blamed. They are under severe pressure, and they are not one party. They are not one government that they sit. They are not civil service either, you see. It's a very difficult, unique situation they are in. So one has to imagine this psychology of that delegation. So one always asks the more powerful and those who've got the chips to be able to give in and show the evidence. And I think they became very hard when they saw what is being offered by the Israeli. They were offered by the Israeli as almost a third or fourth class standard of a human being. So they just couldn't swallow it, couldn't have it at all.
Let me ask you a question that you probably can't answer, but I'll ask it anyway. given the conditions existing that you just described, I suppose one strategy for the Palestinians to adopt would be to take whatever the Israelis were willing to offer and keep talking. And then I suppose the other strategy would be to say, this is the minimum that we're willing to accept, and that's that. And wait until they could get that. what's the path to take? I mean, do you take what you can get and say, all right, we'll take this, but we insist on continuing to negotiate because we're not just going to stop here? Or do you take the maximalist position and say, no, we're not going to yield, this is what we want?
Well, let me answer it in two ways. One from practical thing that in the past so many years, they were told, the Arabs even told, if you accept 242, then peace will come and then your rights will be fulfilled and so on and so forth, even to the Palestinians themselves. Denounce this, denounce terrorism, recognition, what have you. All these things, everybody accepted. Even the conditions of the delegation, what to be and what not to be. They accepted. They accepted a terrific amount of humiliation, the Palestinian, up to this minute. And this goes on. You are asking them to do this the same. I think it should be on the other side to tell them, well, look here, enough humiliation. Show from your side something. So far, this something is not there. Nothing at all. So, I mean, this is the question. Second, you must understand there is a different mentality between the Arabs and the Western thinking. The Arabs, as I said, they want to know that what is the end of the path. In other words, there is a glimpse about the path. You see, it must have come from our long, long generations. We live in the desert. And when a tribe wants to move from one grazing area to another, they send people to, you know, like a scout to see which is the area to go to. And when they come back, they make a plan from A to B because they just cannot go into this desert and roam. They are afraid they may get lost on the way. This is the type, even negotiation, once wants to see what is the light at the end of the tunnel. While the Western thinking on this, no, we walk, and if you find a river, you start building a bridge, and after the bridge you cross, you sit there. If the rain is there, you wait, you grow things, and you build a house, and then you go. You see, these are two different mentalities of trying to get to negotiation. I accept this type of background, because always we are seeing that the Arabs are asking, what is the end of the tunnel, what is the... while the other day say, come on, start, walk in the tunnel. It is dark, but walk, hopefully that you might get something if you get. I mean, these are two things together. But I always say, he who has to give, not those who haven't to give.
Our guest this morning, Dr. Abdel Salam Majali. He's head of the Jordanian delegation for Middle East Peace Talks in Washington, D.C., visiting here in Champaign-Urbana and spending some time with us talking about the Middle East Peace Talks from his own and from a Jordanian perspective. If you have questions, we would welcome them. In fact, we have somebody who is standing by. We will talk to in just a moment. Our telephone number here is 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a couple of people here. Let's start with line number one.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have two questions, if I may ask them, both pertaining more to Jordan than to the peace process. First question, I believe 60 Minutes has reported that before, during, and after the Gulf War, Jordan was still supporting and supplying Iraq all the way from the Jordanian port of Aqaba. And so my first question would be, why does Jordan continue to be an enemy of the United States by supporting Iraq in such a manner? My second question is, why does Jordanian law prohibit selling land specifically to Jews, and why is the penalty, death, so severe? Those are my two questions.
Thank you very much indeed, caller. In fact, these two questions, I heard them even on the negotiating table, so whether they are from the source or the same source, I do not know. But the 60 Minutes, it's a media, and the media... unfortunately, sometimes try to pick the exciting one. Let me go back to Jordan's stand on the Gulf War. We are first, we were the first people in the area to declare and ask for withdrawal from the Iraqi forces from Kuwait. We were against the occupation in principle, exactly like when we now call for the application of 242, which is the inadmissibility of acquisition of land by force. So this is a principle we just cannot go away from. The difference between what took place and what we had in mind, that this problem should be solved in the Arab context. Because if it is otherwise, it will bring disaster, pollution, bloodshed, hate, and so on and so forth. which apparently did. So we were not with Iraq to occupy Kuwait at all, but we were with Arab solution to the problem because we predicted what would come out of that war. Now, we officially, we are just like everybody else, accepted the resolutions from the United Nations to close our borders in front of all material apart from medicine and drugs and food products. And what comes from Aqaba does come to Jordan. But what merchants, like all other borders around Iraq, smuggling and so on, goes on. The very last certificate from the U.S. Embassy and from the United Nations observers, they did give the certificates that we are observing everything. So we are not helping Saddam, who is the enemy of America. I mean, this is out of question to do that. You were talking about the law where you cannot sell Jews. First, in Jordan, we do not have Jews, so the matter is out of question. But when the country, I mean, before we severed our legal and administrative relations with the West Bank in 1988, Jordan laws were observed there. And as you know, Israel has got a lot of money, and it is one of the things that they go, they have a lot of money, so they can push people to sell their own land, and they make conditions for people under occupation to the extent that they have nothing, only this piece of land. So they offer him all that money to sell his land and walk out and immigrate and go out to other places. And we in Jordan, we suffered since 67, apart from the big transfer which took place in 1967, 150,000 people of this kind were pushed out of the occupied territories to Jordan and sharing the meager resources of Jordan at the moment. So this is a law which never been practiced at all, but at least to tell them not to sell land to the occupying power. And on the same side, we know that the law of return, which the Israeli put, allow Jews to come to Israel, do not allow anybody who is not a Jew to come and settle. So the laws have to be for the interest of that country.
Does that get to your question? You want to follow up?
I just can say that I'm completely shocked that you would dare to even say that only Jews can settle in Israel when Jews, Muslims, Christians, anybody can become a citizen. Well, maybe next time you'll actually answer my question, but thank you very much. Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
We are at our midpoint here in our conversation. We'll continue in just a moment. We'd like to tell you about what we're doing on the beginning of next week, and then we'll get back to talking about the Middle East. First of all, Monday morning at 10, we will talk about agriculture and our agriculture news service. Daryl Good will be our guest. He's a professor of agricultural economics here at the U of I, and also Charles Lindy. talk with us. They'll both be joining us by phone, so you'll have the chance to talk with them. And then also next week, Andre Marou will be our guest. He is the Libertarian Party candidate for president. He is going to be joining us by phone also. We thought you might find it interesting to talk with him and hear what he has to say. That's Tuesday at 11 o'clock. Then also next week, we'll have the first of our lawn and garden care shows for this year. Dennis Thompson will be joining us Wednesday morning at 10. He's the Senior Agricultural Advisor with the Champaign County Cooperative Extension Service. And whatever questions you may have on things that grow around your house, you can call in on that. This morning, our guest is Dr. Abdel Salam Majali. He is head of the Jordanian delegation to the Middle East Peace Talks in Washington, D.C., and that's been our topic of conversation this morning. If you have questions, please do call. We have some other folks standing by here, so our next caller is on line number two. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to start by saying that I really very much hope that peace will be achieved and a solution is found for all the problems that exist between Israel and the Palestinians and all its other neighbors. But I wanted to correct, you know, you were saying that Israel is being unreasonable in being afraid going into negotiations after four decades of a war situation. And I don't think Syria has undone its official war situation with Israel, and it is now in control of Lebanon also. And I, you know, the previous caller was referring to the Gulf War, and I want to refer to the Gulf War too, because I happen to have been in Israel at the time, and I remember how Hussein, King Hussein, announced that if Israeli planes went in defense of the Scud attacks on Israel over Jordanian skies, that would be a declaration of war, in a sense, leaving Israel bare to attack. And I can't see that as a good faith statement. It was a very awful thing to do, I think, to the Israeli people. Also, about the Palestinians, you know, you were saying that they are humiliated. I feel that they were much more humiliated by the Arab governments under whose control they stayed since 48 till 67 than since. This is not to say that I don't think a solution needs to be arrived at, or that their situation is fine now. I don't say that. But the 67 situation of Jordanian Palestinians was terrible. You know, what was found there after the 67 war by the Israelis were people who were practically starving without any infrastructure, any education, any health care. And for you as a Jordanian not to address that, that's not fair. Because on many levels, their situation has improved. Again, this does not replace independence. But they were no more independent under the Jordanian law than they were under Jordanian rule than they were under Israeli. So that's, but most important for me, I wanted to ask you about women in the Jordanian law. And this is as a result of the fact that I happen to know of a woman who was decapitated, a young woman who was decapitated in the West Bank by her Arab brother, who suspected her of being of doing something immodest, anyway, it was found after she was dead that she was certainly a virgin, not that it was anybody else's business but her own, in my opinion. But the fact was that since the Palestinians in the West Bank are under Jordanian law, he wasn't even taken to court because we were told there was no law to prohibit such things, and that I found very, very disturbing. And I'm sorry I load so many questions in here, but please, if you can address as many of them as you can. And I thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Thank you very much indeed. You brought quite, as you said, quite many questions, and I hope to answer them in consequence. I think the law of Jordan is not less, not more than any law in any civilized country. Wherever there is a crime, it has to be punished. But in any law, there is something when there is, what is the reason of that crime, whether the judge will accept it or not accept it. But this is, the law is the same. And if you May I advise you to ask for a copy of these laws and read them and to prove to yourself that they are civilized completely. But we have no jurisdiction over in the West Bank now, and so we do not know whether this case has been treated accordingly or not. The second thing, you were trying to say the same thing again, which I had in the negotiation table, that the Israelis were trying to tell the Palestinian that, that the occupation is a very nice thing and they are better off under occupation than with Jordan. Let me remind you that Jordan was not an occupying power. Jordan, with the Palestinians in 1950, they had a conference in Jericho, and the Palestinian asked a union with Jordan, and there was this union took place, and these Palestinians had their sovereignty over the West Bank with the Jordanian, like they have their sovereignty over Jordan as well. They had half of the parliament, half of the senate, half of the government, and most of the business. So they were real shareholders. They were not under occupation by any means. And when you say they were poor, I think if you go to any statistics by United Nations, not just by Arabs or anything, you will find that they were the same standard on both sides. You have to remember that, you know, Israel has a terrific amount of help from the United States, whether economically and or whether in all sorts of forms to better the standard of the people living there. One thing I must tell you again this question came, that at one time somebody in the negotiation saying that during the occupation there were more 200 more beds built on the West Bank than before the time when the Jordanians were there. Well, this is not a true fact, because personally I, when I'm talking to you, I was a minister of health, I was director of health of the armed forces. I personally built two hospitals, very brand new, one in Nablus and one in Bira, complete equipment. And when the occupation came, one is used as a prison, which is in Nablus, and even one of the delegates, the Palestinian delegates, was in that prison, which is used to be a hospital. And the second is the headquarters of the occupation power. So this is a fact, and when I said it, it was a fact. There is no answer on this. Now about Syria occupation of Lebanon. One can use any term he likes, but you have to remember that the Syrians, I am not defending the Syrians, but the Syrians were invited by the Lebanese government, which is in power at the time, to try to help them be there. And by the way, they are far away from the Israeli borders whatsoever. I mean, they are not just there. But an excuse that Israel should be occupying the West Bank and the south of Lebanon because Syria is in the north occupying part of Lebanon, again, sometimes one has to make up his mind. Are the Arabs are brothers and together, or are they enemies themselves? Or they are hostile to each other. So this is a different matter from the other one. And again, what you said about Hussein. Jordan in that stand never allowed either army from the west or the east, Iraq on the east or Israel, and they said it bluntly and clearly that we do not want to be the place for war between the two sides, and we do not allow anything to be. But do you know that we do not have any technical power that these Scud missiles to pass over Jordan, that we have no means of stopping them? And if the Israelis' Scud missiles go the other side, we have no means, because we are powerless on this. And you cannot ask the powerless person to stop these things between two countries, which both of them have enough strength in their own armed forces. Education. Let me tell you something, and this is a fact. You get it again from United Nations books or from any Western books. Today, today the percentage of Jordanians in schools, in the general schools, is one of the highest in the world. 35% of the total population of Jordan is in school today. And in post-secondary education, among the highest, we have over 55% of every Jordanian between the age group of 18 to 23 is in post-secondary education today. I don't think Israel has got this. And most of these people are, again, Palestinians. So you just cannot say that you went to a place where these people are ignorant. They had schools, they have advanced schools, they had advanced. We were shareholders in both sides. And again, at one time, they were saying that there is no university in the West Bank. The West Bank in 1967 was about 600,000 people. And Jordan has only one university, and I was head of that university. And I tell you, the total school the students in that university was very little. So, it is open for the Palestinians. They used to have it because West Bank and Jordan was one country, united together. So you can't go and distribute one small university all over the place just to show that you are on that side. So you cannot claim that the occupation has improved the conditions of the Palestinians.
I have several other callers here, and I'm sorry I can't give the caller an opportunity to follow up. We simply don't have time. And I want to try to get some of these other folks in. There is another question that I would like to ask, and I beg the indulgence of my callers if I do this. I'm just interested in your thoughts about what might happen after the elections in Israel. As people have probably heard, Yitzhak Rabin has now taken over the leadership of the Labor Party from Shimon Peres. And there are some people who think that Mr. Rabin might possibly be able to beat Mr. Shamir, the Likud candidate and current prime minister, in elections, and they're scheduled for June 23rd. In the past, Labor has apparently expressed some interest or made some efforts to negotiate with Jordan to get Jordan involved in some kind of administrative capacity in the West Bank, perhaps to have some kind of joint Palestinian-Jordanian oversight of that area. Apparently, Mr. Peres tried to discuss that with King Hussein some time ago when Peres was prime minister, and those negotiations didn't go anywhere. But the question is, what if Rabin wins? Do you see the possibility that an Israeli Labor government might be able to come to some agreement with the government of Jordan to have some sort of Jordanian-Palestinian administration of the West Bank?
Well, I hope first that the Israeli people will evaluate the present situation of the peace and accept and give a mandate to their electorate, to their leaders, whoever their leaders, whether it's Yitzhak Shamir or Yitzhak Rabin. The main thing is the mandate of peace, and then things will go. I don't know whether this will make this party more powerful than the other party. I do not know, and I don't like even to interfere. But the main thing is the mandate. If the mandate, whether it's Yitzhak Shamir or Yitzhak Rabin, is for peace and the realization of peace, well, it is welcomed, and this is what we hope it will happen. About that Jordan be involved with Israel to over the administration of the West Bank, I can't see the logic of it. Because you want us to be occupying power over, or we are under Israeli to be over the Palestinians. In other words, to have two more countries involved in these people are civilized people, the Palestinians, and they have their own rights. They have their own human rights. People have to recognize their human rights, their decision self-determination. And in the future, if the self-determination to unite with us, we will discuss it and find out. Or they may have some relations of some type with Israel. It is their decision. It's not our decision, but we cannot impose ourselves over the Palestinians and share to police them with the Israeli. I mean, this is
weird. Well, I would think that the idea would be that the Israelis would leave, and that somehow having Jordan involved would, in a sense, give the Israelis the feeling that they could trust Jordan better than they could trust the Palestinians, and somehow that Jordan would be, in a sense, the guarantor that that Israeli security would be protected and that the Palestinians would not pose any threat to.
In fact, the Palestinians themselves in the negotiation table said that they will welcome the confederation with Jordan. They welcome it. More than one time they were saying even they will be disarmed. There is no army. So all the fears. But one has to change into the state of peace. We are talking of peace, not war. We are talking of peace. Once you talk of peace, the feelings and the fears of war should be far away. I am not saying to be dropped in the sea, but to be far away, because we are negotiating peace. Once the peace is prevailing and it is there, and it is being guaranteed by even the superpowers, this is good enough for everybody.
Well, I want to give some more people a chance to talk with you. Let us continue. We'll go to a caller on line number three. Hello?
Yes, good morning. I just heard your comment about education and health, and I just so happened to have a publication in front of me written by Ruth Savard called World Military and Social Expenditures. It's put up by the Rockefeller Foundation. And these are mid-1970s numbers, and I know the later document is at the house, and I'm in my office now, but the numbers are rather revealing. In education, the Israeli ranks 2 out of 138 countries. Jordan ranks 58. In health, looking at population per physician, there are 368 people per doctor, ranking Israel number 2 in the world, and there are 2,846 per doctor in Jordan, ranking at 70th in the world. Life expectancy, Israel ranks 9th, Jordan ranks 72. So I don't think your comment that somehow or other Jordan has caught up and in health actually surpassed Israel is accurate. But my question really was on something else, which is why I called. And it has to do with your own experience with the PLO. We know that back in 1970, you had a very difficult time with the PLO. And it was a threat to your government. It was a threat to your people. And you did what I think any government or people would have to do, and that is you went after the threat. And we know of it as Bloody September, Black September. And you got rid of the PLO. Now, if it is proper for Jordan to take military action, and severe military action, because we remember those days, severe military action against the PLO, why is it improper for Israel now, perceiving the threat as severe as it is for Israel now, as it was for you back in the 1970s, why isn't it proper for Israel to regard itself as still under threat? In 1990, 1991, during the Gulf War, as you just commented before, the Scuds came across from Iraq into Israel. Now, maybe Jordan could not have done anything about it, which is what you claim, but certainly we read in the New York Times, in the Wall Street Journal, and even in our News Gazette, how the Palestinians cheered as the Scuds came in to hit Israel, Israeli population. The Israelis, of course, see that as a continuation of terrorism, as a continuation of a desire on the part, not of all Palestinians, but certainly the leadership, and certainly the PLO, as an attempt still to do what they tried to do unsuccessfully all these years, and that is to destroy Israel. So if Jordan, who has had their own experience of a threat against the PLO and reacted with such severity, far greater than the Israeli severity, why won't you be at least understandable? I appreciate what you say. When we sit down to the bargaining table, one has to look forward and consider peace. But I think it is unreasonable and disingenuous to argue that the Israelis should be more forthcoming than they are right now. And we were hoping, that is, we the Americans are hoping, to get some sign from Arabs, Jordanians, Palestinians, Syrians, that since the Gulf War, something has changed. And the one thing that you could tell us about is the continuing resistance on the part of Jordan to do what Egypt did. And that is to say, all right, we differ with you, that is Israel, on so many things, but we acknowledge, and it's a statement, it isn't just by what you do, it's a statement, we acknowledge your right to exist, your legitimacy. If you would do what Egypt had done, what Anwar Sadat had done, I think it would change the course of negotiations. It would be peace thinking. It would be future thinking. But you refuse to do that. In fact, you voted against the resolution rescinding the Zionism's racism resolution. How can you expect an Israeli to sit across you at a table and take you seriously when you vote against the resolution that calls the very national organization Zionism, you call that a racist organization, racist ideology?
I need to jump in here, or else we won't have any time for our guest to make a response. Please do comment on what the caller had to say.
Well, thank you very much, and I try to answer as quick as I can to all your comments, and thank you for making them and giving me a chance to respond. First, I did not say the standard of health of Jordan is better than the Israelis. The Israelis are far, far, far much better. But what I said, that I'm talking about the occupation and about those people under occupation, they are not better off now than what they were before taking the time lapse, which has gone from 1967 up to now. But in education, I said education within that short period with the limited resources, you must always remember the resources which Israel has from all over the world and from you here in the United States to achieve what they are achieving. It's not just, it's local there. I mean, they have all this support. So that's about health. About 1970, the PLO is not, we are not occupying power in Amman over the PLO. The PLO is an organization for the Palestinians to express themselves. They went into certain violent acts inside Jordan, and we had to stop this to defend ourselves. And they are from outside to us. I mean, we are a state, but what I am talking about, Israel occupation of Palestine, of the West Bank. West Bank is not Israel. Palestine is the West Bank is for the Palestinians, and there is this occupying power. And the whole world is saying this. And the very last resolution last month have said it bluntly and openly, the occupied Palestinians territories. So that's the one. About the cheers in those days. You must remember these people under occupation, and there was no talk of peace. Now we are talking peace. We are not talking past. At that time, certainly there are occupation. There is occupation, and there is a lot of harassment to the people under occupation. So when they see somebody who can start to try to stop the practice of the occupation to them, they might be cheering that. Third, let me say about, I think it is even in the last month, there is the article saying that even in Tel Aviv, during the Scud missiles and what have you, there were less deaths in that city than when there was no things, because people were protected and so on, which is a very good thing to have. Resolution racist. I mean, this is an old resolution in the time of quarreling and so on. And I know last month when it was put to the vote, we were trying and pressing hard to have some signs of change, and some signs of change, whether on the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza or during the negotiations. That's the reason, and we were ready to vote differently if that was science. But we cannot go all the time giving in, and nothing in response. So at least this is the thing. And this sort of resolution does not hurt. It is not an act that it hurts them in any sense, even materially. So that should be, and I don't know whether I had all the other time.
Unfortunately, I'm sorry to say that we're going to have to stop. I'm sure that we could continue, and my apologies. We have some callers that we're not going to take, but we've simply come to the end of the time. We have the hour, and that is that. And I want to thank you very much for coming and being with us. Dr. Abdel Salam Majali is head of the Jordanian delegation to the Middle East Peace Talks in Washington, D.C. Anna Flanagan is standing by. She is a host of our afternoon magazine, and she will be with you for the rest of the afternoon now with news and other things. Anna?
Hi, David. How you doing?
Pretty good. You have some more candidates for people to talk with today.
That's right. This afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour, we will be joined by Champaign County Auditor Laurel Pressing and Champaign County Board Member David Thies. They are running for the 103rd District seat in the Illinois House on the Democratic ticket, so they will be facing each other.